Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
It is my exquisite pleasure to tell you that although, yes, of course, to you, to kind of everyone, that is the theme music for Curb Your Enthusiasm, what it actually originally was, I learned this today. This is not something I've been carrying around with me for a while. It's a song called Frolic. It's composed by Luciano Michelini, an Italian composer. It was composed in 1974 for the film La Bellissima Estate, where it was used to, it was kind of the theme of one of the characters known as the Barone Rosso. I found a clip of it today, too. Once you know that, then it's sort of, yeah, that is obviously from some kind of comic Italian movie. Anyway, it is the theme of Curb Your Enthusiasm as well, which is now in its final season. If you're listening live on Friday, we are just a couple of days away from the final episode. Here's how I contextualize that today. When Curb Your Enthusiasm debuted under its actual title, we were a month and change away from hanging chads in Florida, and did Gore win? Did Bush win? That's how far, to me, that seems so long ago, because it was so long ago. Anyway, here to say considerably more nuanced and profound things about it is Katie Baker, senior staff writer for The Ringer. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
On my drive over here, which is not a long drive, I was listening to, I guess, your putative boss, sort of, maybe, Bill Simmons interviewing Larry David. And they talked for like 4 hours, I would say, about sports. It was really kind of astonishing how much Larry David knows about, you know, the minutiae in history of sports. Go ahead.
Yes.
So, I don't know exactly know where to begin, but I think maybe just to talk to you initially about what it is that you like about Curb Your Enthusiasm. You write from the point of view of a critic and a culture writer, but also from the point of view of a fan.
Yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head even with that intro, in the sense of, you know, Larry David, who we all know as the, you know, one of the creators of Seinfeld, one of the most important, you know, shows that we've ever had in comedy, has this show about himself, and he inserts all these things about his own life. I mean, even in the most recent episode, he brings up the Rangers, and he's always been a sports fan. And then at the same time, his life also involves all kinds of mishaps, misunderstandings, beefs, you know, longtime feuds. And I think the fact that we have just come to know this character over literally a quarter century just has made this not just a show, but kind of a part of American life. There's so many things from the show that come up in everyone's daily lives, and whether they agree with Larry or disagree with Larry. And I think one of the beauties of the show is that often you're on both sides, sometimes even in the same episode.
Yeah, no, and we'll come back to that. I think it's a point that you make, and it's an important one. I think that's easy to miss. I have to sort of confess that I kind of come and go from the show. There are seasons I haven't watched. There are times where the vibe of the show is not right for whatever mood I personally am in. But, I mean, watching it to get ready for the show, I was reminded of some of the stuff that I've liked about it. And one of them is this almost Talmudic palpation of the undocumented rules of life. Right. One of the things that this show has been very much about is when somebody says no gifts for a birthday party, do you bring a gift anyway? When can you leave a social gathering? You know, if you're tired of it, what do you have to do? I mean, all these things, you know, that come up in supermarkets and restaurants and, you know, and they're never spelled out anywhere. It's kind of up to the characters to discuss what the rules are. And to me, there's something not only ingenious, but a little profound about that enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about one of my favorite episodes, which is an early one, where you kind of see both sides of it. It's the episode where, you know, Larry's deciding whether to hold the elevator door for someone or not. And kind of, you know, we've all had that feeling where you hold it too early or you you know, and the person has to do the half jog, and then he does, and then the person gets the, you know, gets to the doctor before him, and even though his appointment is before theirs, they get to go in first. And so, you know, he's now been punished for doing the right thing, which is kind of a recurring theme. You know, he gets punished for doing the right thing, he gets rewarded for doing the wrong thing, and vice versa. But yeah, it really has. I mean, there's so many times in a social situation where, you know, you think every time I put down a cup on a wooden table, I think, you know, do I respect the wood? You know, just all these little, you know, and Seinfeld was the same way. But it does. It makes you think about what of our social customs are for a reason, what are just for show, and what happens when someone, you know, talks about the difference between the two. Sometimes it can offend people or shock people.
I think another thing, I would say that for people who like Curb Your Enthusiasm and wonder what to do when it goes away, if you've never watched the Larry Sanders Show, and maybe also it's Gary Shandling Show, another Gary Shandling product, there is some spiritual progenitor quality that particularly Larry Sanders Show has to Curb Your Enthusiasm. And one of the things that they share, although Curb Your Enthusiasm takes it several miles further, is that weird blurring of reality where you have these just off the hook cameos by Salman Rushdie and Barbara Boxer and my cousin John McEnroe. He's not really my cousin. Dr. Phil, Bill Buckner, Michael Bloomberg, Chris Martin from Coldplay, Alexander Vindman, the major figures in the first Trump impeachment, Mika Brzezinski, Stacey Abrams, and of course, in the penultimate episode, Bruce Springsteen, who, I mean, if you can get Bruce Springsteen, I guess you can kind of get anybody, but and who seemed to kind of know very well the rhythms of the show and how to argue with Larry about whose cup of water that is. But that's kind of an amazing thing, right? There's just, you feel like you're actually in a kind of another cell of the multiverse. You know who all these people are, but they're just not in the right place.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And he, you know, that came about from the very beginning of the show, you know, when you have just the concept of this creator who's the creator of Seinfeld in real life, and you have the actors, you know, in the very beginning of the show was kind of this mockumentary, and you had the creators of the actors from Seinfeld in it as themselves. And, you know, like you said, there had been a few other of these sort of meta shows where there's a show within a show, or there's a person from real life, you know, who's themselves in the show. But this just took it to a whole new level in a way that's funny, because you have all these real life people in the Curb universe, you know, Ted Danson, all these, but then you also have people like Vince Vaughn, but not playing Vince Vaughn. And so it really makes it this meld of what's real, what's not. Obviously Larry David has now, you know, sentenced himself to a lifetime of everyone assuming he's just like Larry David on the show. And while he says he's not, he also kind of is, as as we've just seen with his classic, you know, appearances and his sense of humor in real life. But it is one of the things that's really fun about it. You're watching this view of Los Angeles, and you're seeing what it's like to be a famous person in Los Angeles who Bruce Springsteen wants to come meet. But then you're also getting all this slapstick stuff, and you've got, you know, I love his housemate Leon, who's the brilliant comedian J.B. Smoove. And so he's not playing himself, even though he's a comedian. And it just really makes it into this world that's very much his own and very memorable.
The other thing, you know, initially, Katie, as I was thinking about this show and reading your piece, and which I should probably have said the title of right at the beginning, so I'll do that now, Wincing Time, The Cringe Comedy Legacy of Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I was thinking initially, you know, over the course of 25 years or almost that much, you know, the world changes, and I wonder if they would try to get away with some of the stuff that they did early on. We've been through Me Too. We've been through cancel culture. And then watching this season, it's like nothing has happened, you know? I mean, you know, even stuff like, you know, Asian people who speak, you know, in just two-word sentences, and then he talks back to them the way that they talk, stuff that you really cannot do anymore, you never should have been able to do in the first place. Or the conversation that he has with these two gay men about what they're going to name their son. And he wants to know, it's like he wants to know whose semen, they're having a son through a surrogate. He wants to know whose semen it is in the surrogate, because that's whose last name it could possibly be. And it's like none of the things that society has worried about for the last 24 years have even put a dent in what this guy wants to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. You look back at old episodes and you think, oh, he could never do this now. And then he does it now. I think he's sort of shown himself to be someone who is really looking to, you know, kind of find the boundaries of our society and our formality and push them. But, at the same time, he has also, he's earned the respect and kind of the ability to make those jokes that might seem like very base level if the wrong person was doing it, but he's employing it in kind of a higher way in which he's often making fun of himself almost more so than someone else. But it's what makes it kind of thrilling to watch sometimes, because you just really don't know what they're going to say. And it really doesn't seem like the show has, like you said, changed that much from the early seasons in terms of its subject matter. Or, you know, it's even in the most recent episode, he deals with a transgender person in a way that I thought was kind of well handled. Like, it just showed, you know, we have certain comedians, I won't name names, that seem to have problems with, what they think is the too politically correct these days. And I don't know, I feel like he shows that you can make jokes about these things in ways that are funny without being cruel or without being a bridge too far. And so, yeah, I who knows what's even going to come out in the finale with, you know, given how this season has been. It makes it a fun watch.
Yeah, I think, one thing I thought about Katie was, Norman Lear invented Archie Bunker as a way of lampooning the worst kind of blue-collar bigot. And there were a lot of people who decided that Archie Bunker was lovable and was kind of a walking permission structure, and much to Lear's dismay. But I don't think that's exactly what's happening with Larry David, because everything in this show is a boomerang. It's going to come back and hit Larry in the head sooner or later. Like the transgender thing, we don't want to spoil it too much, but it's really his discomfort and something that comes out about the past and the way that he handled a certain aspect of sex. And everything is going to hit him in the head sooner or later. He might seem like he's the guy throwing the boomerang, but it's just coming back to smack him. And maybe that's what ultimately redeems some of the really transgressive sounding stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it, in some ways it's a nod to the hypocrisy of certain, I would say limousine liberals, but with Larry early on in the show, the early Prius, that this dates the show. It was back during the Prius and when he first got a cell phone, but, showing these Hollywood people that are very liberal in their lives, but still have these hangups, I think is a good way to also lampoon kind of the other side of the pendulum from an Archie Bunker. And I think he does it effectively. And yeah, you do always know he's going to get his comeuppance in some way. And like you said, sometimes he's the one that's the irritant in the situation. And sometimes he's the one who's being irritated. And I think that balance is what makes the show really fun, because watching it, sometimes you identify with, with Larry, and sometimes you identify with the person that Larry is annoying. And so you're kind of always not on edge, but you're kind of always just not sure which way things are going to go. And one thing that's been fun about this whole season as a final season is I feel like they've kept what's so great about the show, which is those little micro things. Like in the most recent episode, the zipper karma, just this little thing where, like, now anytime I struggle with a zipper from now on, I'm going to be thinking of Larry. But then you also have this whole season long arc that's obviously winding up to what will, I'm sure, be quite a conclusion.
Yeah, I think, one other thing, and our producer Lily Tyson wants us to specifically talk about cringe comedy, but before we get there, one of the other micro things, I think, is just, once again, that almost lexicographic interest in language. What do certain words mean? We'll play a little clip from the first episode of this season, but I think you and I have a couple of phrases we want to talk about, too. This is a one cat.
Larry, can I help you?
I just found out you're not paying me. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true.
Are you kidding?
Larry, I'm not paying you because you're in violation of your contract.
Violation of the contract? What?
You said you were going to be cordial. You weren't cordial.
I wasn't. You're saying to me, okay, that I wasn't cordial? I most certainly was cordial.
Do you know what cordial means?
I spoke. Yes, I know exactly what it means. It means to be polite, to be friendly, and not to tell people what you really think of them and what they all were. Yes, that's cordial.
You were not cordial.
So there is almost just the repetition of the word. I was doing that yesterday with the word harbinger in a way that I think, you know, ultimately really irritated everybody. But it's like one of the ones I know you've kind of homed in on was the phrase "no matter what." This comes up in an episode where a hostess, I think it's the original Funkhauser, Bob Einstein's wife, she tells Larry not to let her eat the delicious desserts she's made, no matter what. And Katie, you take it from there and explain what happens.
Oh, so then, you know, later on, she's ready to, you know, the classic, you know, the diet starts tomorrow type indulgence that we've all had. And he is very steadfast to his oath to tell her not to eat it no matter what, to the point where he offends her. And I love that because it just was such a perfect, you know, calling out of this thing that we all say that no one listens to. What happens when someone takes it completely seriously? It ends up, you know, coming back to bite him, and it ends up offending someone. And yeah, you mentioned the word cordial. You know, there's an episode where they talk about foisting a person on someone else. And I think of it anytime I hear the word foisting from now on. And yeah, he's always had such a great just command of these little idiosyncrasies of our language and our culture. And, you know, really just finding the strange little loopholes in them, or, you know, the opposite, like not letting there be any loopholes and showing what happens when you do something like that.
By the way, Katie, I totally get what you mean about how you kind of hear footsteps after one of these phrases or words gets used. For me, it was having said that, because they kind of expose having said that as something that is the prelude. It follows a compliment. And then it's a prelude to the inversion of the compliment.
It's like warning sign, what's about to come.
I can't even say having said that anymore because it's just so obvious what I'm doing. So, you know, we are running a little bit short of time on this segment. But I think we do need to talk. First of all, you know, we should say that the cringe comedy and the Larry David persona, it is unclear how well contained that is. We discovered that over the past weekend when he showed up. I'm in Connecticut right now. He showed up at a basketball game and, first of all, hung his legs over the kind of partition that was in front of him and then started heckling the coach of UConn, Dan Hurley. So it is unclear where fake Larry and real Larry begin and end. But there is a lot of other stuff now that's out there that one could think, you know, whether it's Nathan Fielder or Tim Robinson, these things probably are kind of children of Larry. But give me your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, as you said at the beginning, just to look back at the fact that the show first aired, you know, in like 1999, 2000, how much things were different. I mean, one thing that stood out to me, I went back and read the reviews of the show when it first aired in 2000. And not a single one, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Salon, you know, all these places, they didn't use the word cringe at all. It wasn't, you know, at these days, that word is a noun, it's an adjective, it's a verb, it's, you know, everything is cringe. And at the time it was, you know, we obviously had words like cringeworthy, but it just wasn't this kind of entity in our culture. And, you know, I was looking at other shows that you think of or other movies in that realm. And, you know, the British version of The Office came out in 2001. The American version wasn't even until 2006. We think of that now so much, that kind of style of comedy and the, you know, the sort of shaky camera and the awkward pauses. Even like the movie Meet the Parents, which I think of a lot as like a cringe movie, that came out basically the same time as Curb Your Enthusiasm. So it really was like an early, you know, progenitor to all these other comedians that have now, in a really interesting way, almost reminds me of the way Olympic athletes get faster, higher, stronger, like each time. It's right. It's gotten to the point where now I watch some of these new shows like The Curse by Nathan Fielder, which is brilliant, but it's hard to watch. Like I'm like, my toes are curling, you know? And I, you know, one of Larry David's associates, Larry Charles, called him probably, quote, the most impactful television thinker of the 20th century. And I think you can add the 21st century to that too, because of just the sort of mood of so many comedy and comedic shows that we have now. I think you can really trace back to Larry's work.
All right, we have to stop there, but this has been fascinating, and I really do commend to our readers your piece. We've been talking to Katie Baker from The Ringer. She wrote Wincing Time, The Cringe Comedy Legacy of Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Katie, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, and here's to a great finale.
Okay, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to have two members of our regular Nose team on to talk about this particular brand of comedy.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Can't you tell that I am dying inside? Can't you hear my muffled cry? Do you have to be told 1,000 times? You're the guy who doesn't get it.
That's our good friend Jill Sobule. Joining us now are two other good friends, Sean Murray, stand-up comedian, writer, and the host of the Nobody Asked Sean podcast. That's Nobody Asked Sean, S-H-A-W-N. I don't know why I feel compelled to point that out every time. Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, and dancer, and founder, director, and choreographer of Kinetic Dance, and many other things. But both of you are well-practiced comedians. And so, Carolyn, I saw a documentary one time where Mike Nichols said that the only reasons to tell a joke, and they both need to be there or to do any kind of comedy, he said, A, because it's funny, and B, because it's you. And I know that you, beholding Curb Your Enthusiasm and beholding Larry David in all of his splendor, sometimes think, there's a little bit of me up there on that screen. But what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it does seem weird that I could find like a rich, older white male who has all this like privilege and everything so relatable. And I don't know if it's like, you kind of have a level like where you're sort of, you like hate him, but I think we all relate to him because he perfectly captures the rage that we find in everyday life. And those like details and everything, all that BS, he calls out in such a perfect way. Like just those little things that I personally hate and, you know, try to find the comedy in and to like write with and find things like when those people were making out in front of his window and he bangs on the window and tells them to stop making out and like move along. No one wants to see that. I would have done the exact same thing. I don't want to see somebody else being happy. And, you know, you don't need to be doing that or, you know, just all those every moment that he is able to take and kind of build into this through line for an entire episode is something that I find, I sit there and I'm like, yes, Larry, I feel you. I'm with you. So when I hear this being called cringe comedy, there's a level where I'm like, wait, I don't understand. It's relatable comedy. So maybe that's concerning about who I am.
Well, maybe it is. But Sean, take this wherever you want to go with it.
Well, yeah, I think what Larry does so well is that he keys in on the parts of life that, like, it's like social norms that we didn't all agree to, or like parts of life where it's like, we've all agreed to this, but why? You know, like, why is it this way if we all recognize that this is not the way it's supposed to be done? Which I think is why I think he is so relatable to most people, even in it being cringe, you know, as we say. But I think that the cringe part of it is because Larry is willing to be steadfast in it in the way that most people aren't, like in real life. Like most people, like, you know, I'll just let this moment subside. Larry's going to sit in it. And I think that's the ways in which, like, I see he, like, it mirrors, like, somebody like Nathan Fielder, which I always say, like, Nathan Fielder's strongest comedic sensibility is that his commitment to the bit. He's not going to give up on this idea or this, like, this uncomfortable moment. It doesn't bother him. You know what I mean? And that's what it feels like with Larry. Like, it doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you. So I'll just, you know, I'll take whatever, like, whatever flack I'm going to get for it because it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? I think this is right, and I'm going to stick with it.
You know, I think the other thing about this, Carolyn, or one of the many other things about this, as I've been thinking about it for this show, is that it seems like a pretty simple concept. And it seems even simpler when you know that the premise is set up, but the lines aren't necessarily written. A lot of this stuff is just kind of worked out in front of the cameras. But I think there's also, I mean, maybe it gets back to what you said originally about all of us have this in it. I know you've been enjoying Ted Danson, who's been, you know, doing this for the, and it really kind of spills over really from Seinfeld, where they were used to complain about Ted Danson all the time. But, you know, we've taken this kind of affable, aw shucks guy, the guy who was Sam Malone in Cheers. And as somebody from The New Yorker said, there's a certain pettiness and malice that Ted Danson is beginning to exhibit that I think maybe has allowed him to be a better actor and to pursue other kinds of roles like The Good Place.
Yeah, Ted Danson, since his start on Curb Your Enthusiasm, was sort of is definitely my favorite secondary character, second to Susie Eisman, actually. Susie, I hope we get to talk about her because I think she really helped define a tone for Curb and is a great foil to Larry. But yeah, I love how Ted Danson gets to just be this huge jerk on this show. And it's this version of himself that I hope doesn't exist. Maybe it does, but I think that's one of the things that Curb does so well is blur those lines of reality because you have so many actors playing themselves or a heightened version of themselves. And then you have actors playing a character. So there's this really fun field where when you know that it's all improv and what they're bringing to the table, this working on a show like Curb must be just such a playground for these people.
Absolutely. So, Sean, since she brought up Susie, let's hear a little bit of Susie. This is from much earlier in the run. This is season 2, episode 7. You're going to hear Susie, what she does so rarely, which is yell about something. This is B1.
Where's the head? I know you took the doll's head. Where is it? Where's the head?
I don't know.
The kid is home, hysterical, because her doll, Judy, has been decapitated. Because you two sickos took the head for God knows what reason. Some voodoo you're doing. Where is it?
So go ahead, Sean. Just riff on this.
Well, I think I love I mean, just like in that clip, like how much she squeezes out of the word decapitated is just beautiful. I think Susie's like I was thinking about like Larry and Susie's dynamic is my favorite on the show because it hasn't changed at all. Like, Susie hates Larry as much as she did in the beginning, but it kind of has, in a sense that, like, she, like, I feel like over the seasons, like, there are moments you see more later in the show where, like, they get to a point where, like, she almost likes him. You know, she almost, you know, she's like, you know what, Larry, you're not so bad. And then he goes back to being Larry, or something from earlier in the episode is finally revealed. Like, he told a lie, or he screwed up the situation. And she's like, you know what? No, I do. Like, F you, Larry. Like, we're still here. We'll never get past this point. I feel like she only tolerates Larry. Like, I was like, if Larry was just Jeff's friend, they probably wouldn't ever, she wouldn't tolerate him at all. But the fact that Jeff is Larry's manager, she's like, at least he's paying our bills, so I'll put up with him on that level. But, like, he's intolerable otherwise.
Yeah, I think also, Carolyn, you know, Larry is often up there at an 11, but Susie can go to 13. I mean, you want to have somebody who can get up there at an even crazier, louder, more profane, aggressive level. That you don't want Larry to be just first in his class about anything. But to Sean's point too, there's something going on in this season where she's selling caftans and she has billboards, and something is being sprayed on, a body part is being sprayed onto the billboards. And you see exactly the dynamic that Sean's talking about, I think, which is that she, like, Larry is amused by this, and he also thinks it could be a big plus, and he's right. And she kind of has to meet him halfway on this. This humiliating thing is being done that is going to be actually very lucrative.
Yeah, I love the billboard thing. And FYI, I found out you can buy Susie caftans. They are actually selling them. So if that is something that you think you need in your life.
Christmas is only 9 months away. You're wondering what to get Carolyn Payne. Now you know.
Yes, just sliding that in there in case. But, you know, what Sean said about her vocal prowess of how she enunciates things, and combined with her accent and just the creativity of you know, foul language vocabulary she is able to put together to really drive her point home, really, because Larry almost does seem kind of he's like quiet. It's like an understated rage next to Susie. But, you know, I think there's this tone where they kind of get each other because they're both just angry people. And after all, I mean, he saved Susie's life. If he hadn't bought all those sponge cakes when she got pushed out the window, she'd be dead.
I love how you refer to that like it's sort of something that happened in the Bible or something that we would all know about that particular thing. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, Sean, we talked on the show about various other kinds of comedy and other kind of comedy that has come along. And I can't remember whether you were on the episode where we talked about I Think You Should Leave, the Tim Robinson show. Although if you weren't, can't imagine why you wouldn't have been on that. But that strikes me as somebody saying, I wonder if I could make it even weirder and more uncomfortable, but in a scripted way. I don't know, maybe. Tell me how you see the relationship between those two brands of comedy.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think You Should Leave could not exist without Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I also think You Should Leave is part of the reason why Curb Your Enthusiasm needs to end. Like, I think Larry even recognizes that, which is like, I Think You Should Leave is what that is in the modern setting. And I think like Larry, he even talked about this a little bit where he's like, the Larry David character on the show is not who I am in real life. And I think the part of the reason why Curb can't be as incisive in certain ways as it once was, or like as button pushing, not that it was, that's its full intention, but it's like, it can't be that, is because it's not at the forefront of what that is anymore. You know what I mean? Larry, it's not completely outdated, but it's like, he's not young enough and engaging enough with the world to recognize the ways in which someone would be, like that uncomfortable presence. But I think You Should Leave is brilliant. You know, it's almost the inverse of the situation where Larry in Curb Your Enthusiasm wants to be like, hey, I'm right about this and you guys are going to recognize it. But he doesn't care if he's liked. Whereas Tim Robinson's character, I think the brilliance of I Think You Should Leave is that, like, it's called I Think You Should Leave, and literally every character he plays in every sketch is the person that you want to leave the room. Like, please get out of here. But he doesn't want to leave the room. He really wants to be like, hey, like, he wants to be liked so bad. And I think that's so true of, like, like that type of person in today's world where it's like, no, please accept that I don't suck. Like, you guys just give me a chance. And I think, I don't think we could ever have that show without first having Curb Your Enthusiasm. But I think it's also part of the reason why it's like, we won't miss Curb as much as we might have, like, if it went off the air 10 years ago, because there is a, I don't want to call it a replacement, because you can't replace it, but it's like there's something that kind of fills that space.
Yeah, and that and Fielder, I think, and other people are going to lead us into new territories of discomfort. And, you know, Carolyn, one of the things that I was thinking about getting ready for the show and watching the final season is whether there are things that he can't get away with, because he tries to get away with everything. Now, I'm going to have to describe this next thing rather delicately, or as delicately as it can be described. But there is an episode where Larry, who in real life I think is 76 years old, hooks up with a character played by the actress Essence Atkins. And it's the downtown thing. I was looking at the two of them and thinking, Essence Atkins is about 52, but she looks like she's maybe 40. I don't know. I thought, how are we supposed to relate to this? Is this kind of Larry's fantasy that a really attractive black woman who's much younger than he is would be interested in him? Are we supposed to be just grossed out by it, which I sort of slightly was? I don't know. It's like he seems to be able to get away with almost any kind of fantasy, maybe because the fantasy is immediately so self-puncturing.
Yeah, I got nervous there because I feel like I'm always set up on this show to accidentally say something, some bad thing. I was like, please don't make me describe this. I think they address that on the show a lot. Like, how does he get these women? Like when he says that Sienna Miller is into him, and I think it's Susie. It's like, no, she's not. Because yeah, how and why? I think the whole run of the show, we've seen him just get women, you know, ever since he and Cheryl broke up, we've seen him get women that are just like unthinkable. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to say that I would like take the opportunity to be with Larry David, but like I could understand there'd be some appeal. He probably would be an amusing time, but as far as like Larry having these crazy hot girlfriends and situations and being able to kind of say and do whatever he wants, it does seem, in a world of everyone being canceled, it is impressive that Larry David just like goes right on that line where he just doesn't, he doesn't cross it and doesn't manage to get canceled.
Yeah. So I mean, he goes what many people would say, that's he's over the line, but somehow or other he is also bulletproof. So yeah. Sean, one of the things that we've only had a chance to allude to, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we talk about that we might compare it to, whether it's both versions of The Office or Arrested Development or I Think You Should Leave, those are all scripted shows. And one of the unusual qualities of this show is there is a kind of rawness because so much of it is improvised out of a basic overarching storyline. One of the things that I've been enjoying this season, there are a number of moments where Leon, the character played by J.B. Smoove. But J.B. Smoove clearly improvises in a way that catches David off guard and he just bursts out laughing. And they keep the take because the laugh makes sense in that context. And I almost can't think of another show or brand where you could get that exact feeling. You made somebody laugh in a way that makes sense in the scene, even though it's not in the script.
Well, I think that's a testament to, one, the world that Larry's created in Curb, which kind of addresses the point about, like, how could he be dating Essence Atkins? But also just the how, like, J.B. Smoove in real life, but Leon in the show specifically, is so funny and so outside of what Larry is most commonly experiencing. Like, the type of people, like, Ted Danson won't say any of the things. He would never say... If you put all the words that J.B. Smoove has ever said in life into a pile, and you put the same pile of words for Ted Danson, there would be like maybe 7 words that they've ever shared. You know what I mean? Like, they're just so wildly different that like it would be that like you can't, I can't imagine a situation where he would say these things and you wouldn't laugh. And I think it's one of the things that you get into the editing room is like, you know what? Like, yeah, I think I would laugh at that. Even if it, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's part of the Curb thing is like, there is a, even though it's, you know, partially scripted and it's, you know, it's a TV show, there's an idea of like, this is sort of as close to real life as you're going to get. So in real life, you don't hear something, the funniest thing you've ever heard, and just like shrug it off. You actually would laugh. You're like you would, or you would even say like, that's ridiculous. Like he said that to Leon all the time. Like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. But he's, as he's laughing, because like, it is funny. And I think that even goes to the point of just like building that world is what allows you to have him like dating someone like Essence Atkins or like Elizabeth Banks or whoever it may be, and you not really question it. But I think there's also some truth to it in the sense that like, going back to like, this is what I said about, this is kind of skews closer to real life than a lot of other shows, where it's like a guy like Larry David would be able to attract a certain amount of women because he is like, I think people always have this idea, like you have to be super attractive to like how would a super attractive woman be attractive?
Carolyn just wants to, yeah, Carolyn just wants to go out to lunch with him so that they can both yell at the waiter about why they should say, you know, serve eggs after 11 o'clock. All right. We have to stop there, but it has been fun to break. We have to get a little break here, but it's been fun to talk to Sean Murray and to Carolyn Payne. We will come back after this. Goodbye and good luck. All right, time to thank our technical producer, Kat Pastor. Senior producer Lily Tyson is the producer of this episode. We're going to end the episode with a conversation about actual real-life awkwardness. To do that, we are going to talk to Tai Toshiro, a psychologist by training and author of the book Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. So, Tai, I have to begin by saying that I am notoriously socially awkward. And it strikes me that when we talk about awkwardness, whether it's in the context of Curb Your Enthusiasm or in real life, there's really kind of a three-part structure to it. There's whoever or whatever is creating the awkward situation. And then there's the situation itself. And then there's the person who's being made to feel awkward or uncomfortable. But maybe you can say a little bit about how you see that. I know you even watched a few episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm to get ready for this. I don't know. What do you see in all that?
Yeah, I did watch episodes. I have to admit, it's so awkward sometimes. I get so uncomfortable. I can't continue watching. But I did enjoy catching up on a few. And you're totally right about the architecture of awkwardness. So awkward situations occur when there's deviation from a relatively minor social expectation. And so you have the person violating the social expectation. There's the social expectation itself and the situation. And then there's the other person, right, who has to witness it or is on the receiving end of it. So, those are kind of the three components.
You know, there were social science experiments way, way back decades ago where they would do stuff like put a bunch of participants in an elevator car and they would all be facing the back wall of the elevator and to see what would happen when an unsuspecting person got on. And quite frequently, they would face in the same direction as everybody else. And to me, that's a lot of this, too, that there's a moment where you either have to acknowledge the strangeness and awkwardness of a situation or go along with it. That so much of the tension is kind of about that. Do I violate what's going on here? But yeah, give me your take.
Yeah, no, our brains, for all their power, so much of that goes to regulating our social interactions. And even when we're not doing anything, our brains tend to default to thinking about social interactions or how we're going to handle them or social problems that we might have. We're just incredibly social creatures. And so, yeah, like in those elevator studies, even though it feels weird, we will do what everyone else is doing just to fit in, especially for people who are socially adept. So most people have no problem navigating everyday social life and they'll suffer these kind of minor insults or discomforts, right, that happen every day, actually, just for the sake of making the interaction go smoothly. Someone like Larry David is stubborn in that way and less likely just to go along with things. And so much of the trouble he gets into is just because he gets fixated on something that's a relatively minor thing.
You know, the French have an expression, l'esprit d'escalier, the wit of the staircase. It refers to what you realize you should have said later when you're on the stairs leaving or whatever. I guess that's what the meaning of the phrase is. But I think for the socially awkward person, for someone like me, maybe someone like you, there's a lot of that too. It's, you know, the person who's socially fluid or just very, very confident doesn't do this as much. But I think socially awkward people after an exchange that maybe didn't go well, there's an awful lot of time worrying and perseverating. And what should I have said? How could this? Did I say something wrong? Did that go as wrong as it felt? What was wrong with it?
Exactly. Exactly. So there's been actually a lot of studies done on how socially fluent people process social situations versus awkward people. And, you know, socially fluent people, so they come into a social situation and they have like a broad top level goal. Like, let's just, I'm at this party, I'm supposed to get along with people so I can get paid to be here for this appearance. And so let's just have things go smoothly. And then they'll improvise, usually without much problem, right? To meet that broader goal. Now, awkward people, someone like Larry David, they almost by default tend to process social situations bottom up. So everything's fragmented. There isn't that that fixation on like a broad goal, like let's just get along here. Rather, they get fixated on details. There was an episode where his optometrist dropped some pirate's booty, a snack, on the floor. And I even love the camera work that just zeroes in on this non-social object. And then he gets really fixated on it and gets rigid and stuck on it. And so even in some of these fMRI studies where they watch your brain in motion, they can see that, you know, awkward people are actually really interested in getting along. They really want to do the right thing and do the right thing for you. But one of the things where they get tripped up is they have less ability to access the parts of the brain that are improvisational and flexible, and they tend to get stuck in these kind of rigid social rules.
Yeah, I think also, you know, I wasn't surprised to find out from my producer that you hadn't heretofore watched Curb Your Enthusiasm, because I think if one, I'm a socially awkward person, I find Rosemary's Baby hard to watch. Now, just quickly to review the plot of Rosemary's Baby. It's a horror movie. Mia Farrow's character is pregnant. She's living in this apartment building. There's sort of nice people living in the apartment building. And you gradually realize that all these nice people, including her husband, spoiler here, are Satanists. And so there's something really wrong with the baby, too. To me, the most horrible part of that is she's going to have to acknowledge that at some point. She's going to have to break the shell of conviviality that's been going on in this apartment building and say that Ruth Gordon and all these other apparently nice people are truly evil. And as an awkward person, I almost can't stand to watch that part more than what's really supposed to be the horrific payoff of the movie.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, there's that vicarious emotion, right? And you can even see in some of this research that the parts of the brain where the person is experiencing embarrassment, if they're doing the awkward act, the people witnessing it are having this parallel kind of activation where they're feeling it viscerally in the same kind of way. So it can be incredibly uncomfortable and unpleasant just to watch somebody else, even on TV, right? Engaged in a awkward moment. I'm glad you bring up that episode, because one of the things I was thinking about is that this genre of cringe reminds me so much of horror movies in the sense that, you know, it's unpleasant to think about getting killed, for example, but we still watch horror movies and there's something thrilling about that. And this cringe genre, to me, actually really parallels the psychology of horror movies in that we don't want to be embarrassed all the time, but yet we're somehow drawn to watching somebody else do it.
Yeah, I think if we're socially awkward and we're watching these situations, it is a horror movie, you know? It is watching Curb Your Enthusiasm is kind of a horror movie. It's the stuff that the socially awkward person goes through life hoping very much to avoid.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, that was part of my thought. I thought, well, if you're socially adept, you could probably watch this and think that would never happen to me. Mm-hmm. But I've sat there watching it thinking, oh, wow, this is real life.
Right.
right here.
Yeah, Ben Stiller just gets stabbed in the eye with a toothpick. What am I going to do? Yeah. Anyway, Ty DeShiro, so great to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your expertise, psychologist by training and author of the book Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. And we will say thank you very much for listening. Thanks to Lily for producing, Kat for tech producing. And we'll be back next week with lots of fun. She said my spirit doesn't move like it did before.
She said that I don't look like me no more, no more. I said I'm just tired. She said I'm looking like a bad man, smooth criminal. She said my spirit doesn't move like it did before. She said that I don't look like me no more, no more. I said I'm just tired. She said you're just tired. And I said I saw you in the water. And I said I saw you in the water. Make you cringe. And I said I saw you in the water. Make you cringe. And I said I saw you in the water. Make you cringe. And I said I saw you in the water.